Well, good evening and welcome to this event. My name is Denis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies and a Fellow of this college. My job is the easy one tonight. I just have to moderate and referee and umpire and make sure everybody sticks to the time limit. So otherwise, very welcome. These events are sponsored by three institutions, really. The first is the one we're in, Woolston College. But you also see the banner of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society. This is an independent institution linked to the university, but independent of the university. Our task is to try to bring academic research to a wider audience, make it more accessible, bring people together for discussions of this kind, and so on. So it's not a research institution itself, but it's trying to develop a spread research, disseminate research, make it more accessible and available, and also to provide a forum for discussion of this kind. And the third institution is the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, which is a research centre in the university, set up more than 40 years ago now and still thriving, and quite a few of us are from the Centre for Sociolegal Studies. So these events are all done under the umbrella of the cluster, the research cluster in law, justice and society here in the college. And that really means the three institutions jointly coming together for this purpose. So we have tonight the discussion of a book, The Role of Informal Economies in the Post-Soviet World, The End of Transition? And the authors are Colin Williams, John Round, and Peter Rogers. Fortunately, we have one of the authors here with us. John, welcome.
Thank you.
We will be taxing you closely about this book. So the idea is we will have two presentations, and then we'll have two discussants, basically. So each of the presentations will take, well, it's being negotiated. I would have said 20 minutes. Let's make it 25 minutes. The discussants will be, of course, much briefer. But let me introduce our panelists this evening. So first of all, Dr. John Round, who divides his time between Birmingham and Moscow. John is a socioeconomic geographer whose main research interest is concerned with how people, households, families develop tactics to cope with marginality in all its forms. I won't go through his complete research record, but just to say that he's currently working on a major long-term project supported by the Open Society Institute Foundation to explore the everyday experiences of labor migrants in Moscow and various other parts of the former Eastern Soviet Union. This project, undertaken alongside others, I won't go into all their names, examines the problems labor migrants face in Russia and the impact of migration on those remaining at home. In order to bring this project to fruition, Dr. Round is spending most of his time at the moment in Moscow at the National Research University Higher School of Economics, where he is part of the Faculty of Sociology and the Center for Advanced Studies. So it's a great pleasure to welcome the author here tonight. Our second presentation comes from Dr. Nicolette Makovicki, who is a departmental lecturer in Russian and East European Studies. Nicolette, before taking up this position, was a junior research fellow here at Woolston, for a familiar face around for many years, and had now moved on to the department. She trained in European ethnology at Copenhagen and did her doctorate in anthropology at University College London. After conducting long-term fieldwork in Slovakia and Poland back in the previous decade, she has two main areas of interest. One is the way socioeconomic reforms and EU integration on historically embedded modes of economic activity in Central Europe, etc., particularly artisan crafts, pastoralism, and the heritage industry. The second area of interest is in issues of ethnicity and borderland studies. I hope I've got this right. Mm-hmm. And this second area of research has resulted in a number of articles, book chapters, as well as two forthcoming edited volumes. I won't go into all the names, but they're available if you'd like them. Good, so there are two main presenters tonight, but we also have two distinguished discussants. First of all, Dr. Agnieszka Kubal, who is currently British Academy Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the Centre for Social and Legal Studies, and we're very pleased to have her. She did her doctorate at the Centre for Social and Legal Studies after coming here from Poland. Her research interests lie broadly at the intersection of legal and migration studies. She joined the centre after finishing her doctorate. She joined the centre, she joined the International Migration Institute for a number of years, where she was working on migrants. And then, most recently, she has come home to the Centre for Social and Legal Studies. She's the author of Sociolegal Integration, Polish Post-2004 EU Enlargement Migrants in the United Kingdom, published by Ashgate in 2012. As a British Academy postdoc, her research aims are to advance new theoretical perspectives on the interplay between migration governance and migrants as agents responding to the new socio-legal environment. And her particular case study is of Russia. So we have quite a lot of heavy artillery on the eastern part of Europe here tonight. And perhaps the biggest, heaviest, and most serious gun of all is Marina Kirchner. Marina is a long-standing member of the Centre for Sociolegal Studies, fellow of Wolfson College, deputy director of the Centre for Sociolegal Studies now for some years, and really a very central plank in the intellectual profile of the Centre for Sociolegal Studies. Marina comes from a sociological background to the study of law and society, and has specialised over the years in transitional societies with extensive research in Russia, Ukraine, and other places in that part of the world. Her present research, and it's a little vague to me, but it is about culture, and I think that's with a C, although she says it may start with a K.
No, it's about law.
It's about law, legal culture, and so Marina has been carrying out a lot of serious empirical research. I'm making it rather light, but it is actually very serious empirical research on legal culture in Russia and other places such as that. So, as you can see, we have a very strong panel here tonight. And so now I'll turn to our first presentation, Dr. Rout.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation to talk here this evening, and thank you for coming. I'm on a bit of a world tour of doing presentations at the moment. I was at Kyoto University a couple of weeks ago and sat down talking about the time, and I'd prepared for an hour, and they said, oh, can you talk for 2 hours? So I can talk, so I
no,
will
no,
need some...
25 minutes will be fine.
Yeah. What I want to do tonight, I mean, is just to talk around the book and some of the ideas that we've been developing, and to think about the question mark at the end of the book title, and then to think about how we're developing the project, developing the ideas in our new project looking at migration in Russia, which I think is revealing even more about state-society relations and what we could call the informality trap that many people find themselves within. And I think it's very important to say the start of a talk about informality is it's across the world. It's not something that's just unique to the post-Soviet space at all. And, you know, when you give a talk in America, it's many different disciplines, and people come up with all different examples, you know, and the same sort of things happen here. What I would argue, though, is in Russia and other former Soviet countries is the closeness of the informal to everyday life and the necessity of the informal to get things done. Whereas the European Union and the European Commission picked up on some of our work and included questions on informal payments into their Eurobarometer surveys, and found as you go across Europe, in Eastern Europe, the informal wage is part of your main wage, and in as you go further west, it becomes part of overtime or cash in hand work on top of your formal job. So there's a real geographical dimension to this, but I think it is very important just to say, you know, this goes on, these practices go on in many different countries. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about theory tonight, but I'm a geographer. the words that go in front can change depending who I'm talking to, but mainly a social economic geographer. And I'm particularly interested in how we think about the economy or the economic. And I'm very much influenced by the work of Gibson Graham and their economic iceberg, where you have at the top, you know, wage labour, which is what we talk about, what economists talk about, what we think about in discourse as the economic. But underneath it, we've got what supports everyday life. So volunteering, self-employment, moonlighting, community support, all different forms of what we can term informal economic practice. So my view of the informal is very broad. So it's not just cash in hand work, but it can be about relationships, it can be about exchange, different forms of economic rationale, so environment, social, etc., etc. And from this, Gibson Graham come with a big framework of what we can mean by the economic. You know, so it's, you know, it's this idea of questioning transition is where do we start from and where does it finish? So it's especially in Russia, it's, transformation is a much more appropriate word. It's still an ongoing process, and we really don't know where it's going to end up. And those steering it don't know where it's going to end up as well. Throughout my career to date, I've worked looking at, as was mentioned in the introduction, about the everyday, about how people cope with marginalisation. My PhD was in Magadan, which is in the far northeast of Russia, looking at Gulag survivors and how they cope with very low pensions. And then we began to work, myself, Colin and Peter, in Ukraine, and we've looked at graduate labour market, access to higher education, access to work, coping with retirement, etc., etc., etc. And across this is the work of Lefebvre de Certeau, thinking about how we practice the everyday and how, using the work of de Certeau, there are strategies and tactics. So it's the strategy of the state, of the powerful, to develop economic practices and processes and to protect them in a social, legal manner in order to advance their own agendas, be it political, financial, etc. And in those spaces, people develop tactics as a resistance to these strategies. So that's the main theoretical thrust of our arguments. Of course, people can have strategies and tactics at the same time and vice versa, and it's temporal and spatial. So we're not setting up a binary. The work and the book is very much moving away from these binaries of the formal and the informal and showing that how there's very deep interrelations between the two and how we argue in the book that the formal can't cope without the informal. And a lot of the people that we interviewed do their formal work in order to fulfil their informal practices, whether it be through developing networks, stealing things from the workplace, moonlighting, for want of a better term, using company tools, products, customers, etc., etc. So we very much think in terms of these relationships. As I said at the start, is in Russia, is the informal is really part of the everyday. And it's very visible. And this is just off Red Square. I was just walking around taking some photographs for another presentation and came across these two bears, which he's been paid. They were having photographs taken by them and they're just being paid in cash. And Red Square is quite interesting for this, of the informality that happens around it. And the state is constantly saying we need to be more formal, we need to bring the informal sector into the formal, we need to increase taxation, but it occurs visibly, and there's very little that's actually done. Where the work is at the moment is on labour migration into Moscow and Kazan from Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And what we're particularly interested in is ideas of illegality. As if anyone followed the mayor of Moscow elections last year, is the single topic that was discussed was migration. And in virtually, we've done a media analysis of the campaigns, and virtually every article, we've looked at about 2,000 different newspaper articles, virtually every article said the illegal migrant, even though about 3 million migrants are allowed in the country on formal work permits or temporary patents, which they pay for every month, it's the illegal migrant. And the discourse is, by illegal, they mean informal. So not paying tax, not having proper registration, not contributing. So you get Navalny saying, well, migrants shouldn't be allowed on the metro because it's subsidised. Why should foreigners get access to these sorts of subsidies? So we're particularly interested in looking at this notion of informal illegal around migration. Returning to previous projects, one of the biggest informal relationships was with the employer. So many people are paid two wages, one very small, normally formal, taxed, and the other is cash in hand. And from our surveys and interviews, about a third of respondents said that they get some form of informal payment. And for younger people, this goes up to about 40%. And it can range from 20 to 80% of overall income. So some people, it's very, very important. And we're doing some work in the construction industry, which is, apart from the migration project, and everyone we talk to gets paid cash in hand. You know, it's a major, major problem. It seems, when we started this project, we thought, informality is not a bad thing because you're not paying tax. But, you know, it's a very naive entry into the research field. But, you know, people want to be formal. You know, it's you've got no security, you've got no pensions, it's very difficult to get credit. So there's a real desire for formalisation. And at the same time, you get the state saying, we want the economy to be more formal. So it's, except about 50% of GDP is informal in Russia. And I would argue it's much more if you take a broader definition of it. But, you know, when the state is saying it's around 50%, you know it's a very, very serious issue. And it's very important to households. You know, across time living in Russia and working in Ukraine in the project, it's very, very rare to meet someone that didn't have some form of informality in their household budget. And then informal relationships with accessing healthcare, accessing education, etc., go across the spectrum. Within the book, we talk about many different examples of informal practices. And this is a relatively common one, as a factory worker earns 1,200 rubles a month officially, which is now about £200 a month. Been a good month, can make almost four times that by basically stealing meat from a workplace, selling it to people who sell it at the market. And these are very, very complicated trust-based networks, which involve a great deal of people. And I'll come on to that, the spatiality between the production and the sale of goods again in a minute. But these are very common things, you know, hairdressers diverting clients, doctors putting people to the front of the queues for payments, etc., passing university students, entrance into schools. You know, everything you look at has some element of informality within it. Where we're thinking at the moment is about this informality trap, and this is turning what the government says on its head. Who they very, very much argue it's, informality is to try and cheat the state out of tax revenue, which in enterprises it is to a certain extent. And Russia is seen as a low tax country. It's 13% income tax, but 30% payroll tax. So it's actually a very, very high tax base for employers. And it's a nightmare for us as on our projects, where you've got to be paying 43% tax. For our research assistants from Central Asia, if we were doing it formally, which is impossible to do, it would be over 70% tax. It's just absolutely crazy. So you don't want to register employees because you don't want to be paying this high rates of tax. Subcontracting, I'll talk in a bit more depth in a minute about, makes things even more complicated. And registration is a nightmare, and the whole work permit system is incredibly complex. So if you want a formal work permit to bring in migrant labour, you have to apply a year in advance. So no one knows how much labour they're going to need, so people with the knowledge and the contacts to get the migrants' invitations just hoard the labour. And then if it's not needed, then they might barter some of them away or more than likely just keep it. So it's an absolute nightmare to actually do. I'm obviously a migrant in Russia and I'm on a highly qualified status scheme. And it's one of the easiest to actually do now. But what we're finding is that you have to earn a certain amount per month, a relatively high amount. This has been used to bring in labour migrants from Central Asia because it's very easy to do. So a company will say, we will pay this migrant £2,000 a month, get this visa very easily, and then obviously pay them a fraction of that amount. So it's incredibly complicated. And migrants, the majority, are legally entitled to be in the country, which makes this illegal informal distinction even harder. We've been doing some work around this shopping mall and this French supermarket where the salary is about £1.60 an hour compared to a salary of a supermarket in Britain or France. And the cost of goods is just as expensive as in Britain. So it's Moscow is characterised by high prices and low pay. And one of the reasons for this is someone I've been working with, who's an advisor to the ex-finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, says that because of informality, everything you buy in the shop has been through five or six different informal processes, whether it's to get it through customs, whether to get access to transport, etc., etc. And each of those has its own logic and its own profit. So he estimates that everything you buy in Russia is 1.5 to 2 times the price it should be because of corruption and informality. So it has a massive impact on everyday life. And then within the supermarket itself is subcontracting, which it presents itself, and many companies present themselves as this is an invitation to work as a cashier. You have to be citizen of Russia, you don't need any experience, you work between 80 and 40 hours a week. So it seems very formal. But the jobs, the vast majority of jobs are subcontracted out. So the supermarket will pay an employment agency a certain amount of money. They then go to and recruit migrant labour, they don't look at work permits, they don't look at citizenship, and they pay them less than they should be given. They're paid in cash, no healthcare benefits, holiday pay, no, they don't get paid for lunch breaks, etc., etc., and they're forced to be informal. They cannot get, even though this is a formal job, they cannot become formal because of the subcontracting. And this is a major problem. Even if you've got a work permit and you're legally entitled to be in the country, getting your employer to register you properly is very, very difficult. I mean, for me, I've got two different contracts which has two different registrations. I'm registered to live in my office, and this is with a whole department to help foreign academics work in Moscow. So if you haven't got the knowledge, haven't got the support, it's virtually impossible to do. We've been giving our interviewees cameras to take photographs of their everyday lives, and this is one woman who she used to work at my university, and the university does the same subcontracting of labour out. So, but she works somewhere else now. She's allegedly formal, but she's got an illegal work permit because it was too difficult to get one. She's subcontracted out, so she hasn't got a contract or anything like that. And then for a very, very long working day and working week, she earns about just over £300 a month. And every spare hour has to be informal working. So cleaning people's apartments, looking after kids, etc., etc., etc. So it's a very, very difficult everyday life if you're informal. If by some, and I suppose this happens to me, you are legal at work, the next big problem is getting your where you live registered. And for migrants, the pay, as I've mentioned, is extremely low. Moscow is an incredibly expensive city, so they tend to live like this. They built these beds themselves. There's eight people in the same room. They pay about £80-90 a month to the landlady, and who obviously won't register them. So they've got a fake residency permit. So even this guy here, he's got a formal work permit. He is actually registered, but he can't register where he lives. So if he gets stopped by the police, he's informal, he's illegal. So there's a real struggle here. And this isn't just migrants. This is people from outside of Moscow that move into the city have exactly the same problems. The biggest fear for migrants, especially, is being stopped by the police. And this is a particularly troubling incidents and area. He's here. You see a migrant being stopped by the police. This is close to where you go to register your formal work permit. So you go, you hand over your documents, and then a week later you have to go and pick them up. And what the police do is wait by the metro for the migrants coming to pick up their papers, stop them, ask to see their documents. They haven't got them. They put them in the back of a van. They sit there for 5 or 6 hours, and eventually they just give the police some money to be let go. So it's, you know, this really horrible predatory informality. It's the police from there, it's the only people that are allowed to check your documents are from the Federal Migration Service. The police aren't allowed to stop you and ask for your documents unless you've done something wrong. They think you've done something wrong. We, Open Society, about 10 years ago did a survey on the metro that said you were 800 times more likely, or some very high figure, to be stopped by the police on the metro if you've got of Central Asian appearance. We replicated that and eventually gave up because it was just everyone who was stopped by the police is of Central Asian appearance. The migrants lack knowledge and they're scared as well. You know, we've interviewed a lot of people who have just given money to police or given jewellery to the police or whatever they've got on them, just to get out of the situation. The picture at the bottom is on the Russian-Ukrainian border, and these are migrants. We're doing some work in this area. And these are migrants that you're allowed to be in Russia for 90 days, and then you have to leave the country, come back in, and have a new document saying that you're allowed to be in the country. It's relatively cheap to buy a fake residency permit, entry permit. And if the police don't check it, it's good enough that they will, you know, it's a good enough forgery. If they check on the database, then obviously it will come up. So a lot of migrants make the journey to the border, cross, then come back in. But this is everyone we've interviewed has said this, is it's a $50 bribe to leave the country and another $70 to come back in. And we've interviewed some of the border police, and they say they have to pay their boss $5,000 a day between them. And we've had, it was discussed in the books, very similar experiences on the Ukraine, Hungarian borders, where the border guards have to pay tribute to their bosses of thousands of dollars a day to keep their positions there. And I think this is very revealing of how, again, of this informality trap of what I argue is Russia's biggest problem is it's the form of economy that's developed works for too many people. So in all spheres of life, governments, education, healthcare, etc. So if the border police is paying $5,000 to his boss, he's paying a percentage of that to his boss, to his boss, to his boss, to his boss. You know, in the book we talk about teachers who give informal lessons and have to give a percentage to the head teacher, otherwise they'd be reported to the tax authorities. So you're just trapped in this system. And although in the government there's constantly anti-corruption drives, and Navalny and Sobyanin constantly went on about anti-corruption and stopping informality, but it just works, and there's no real desire to change, I would argue, and it becomes a motivational choice or a career choice to move into a government or state position because it offers you opportunities to seek rent. So you have a whole, well, probably second generation now of people moving into political careers or into the administration or into the police, not out of any civic duty or to help develop the city or etc., but because of the opportunities it offers. And therefore, people become stuck in the system. It's incredibly hard to escape. Elena Ledanova talks about Sistema, that you can't, once you're in, there's so much compromising material on you because you've been taking these informal payments, you can't get out because someone can destroy your career or cause a great deal of trouble for you. And also as well, it's incredibly hard for people to enter the system and not be informal because you're the other. You know, why are you there? Why aren't you taking part in these processes? And I think that's a very important point.
John, your time just sped up. You
right? Yeah. Just one more slide. Thank you. Around this, informality forms a whole sphere of this semi-legal areas. So you pick on the train, as you know, you can get registration, you can get a medical card, you can get a labour card, if you phone up, go to a meeting and pay money. And the Russian government's actually introduced a system where you can pay, I think it's about £20 a month to work as a domestic cleaner, and you will be legal and you have a stamp in your passport. The only problem is no one told the police about this system. So people were having their passports checked, but police were going, what's this? This is just nonsense. You know, this isn't a work permit, and we're then arresting them or just taking money off them. So even if you are fully legal, you still have problems with the police. It's McDonald's. This is by the main mosque in Moscow. I mean, he's absolutely incredible, the informality that goes on in here. The selling of subcontracting of work, also the selling of fake labour permits. And the guys outside, the bodyguards and fixers and people on mobile phones, you walk up the stairs and we walked round and you could see people paying money under the table, and they saw us, that we saw them, and all of a sudden bodyguards appear on the stairs, which is quite a strange experience in McDonald's. But, you know, it's everywhere, and it develops this whole semi-legal system. You know, the work permits have obviously been stolen from somewhere, but then they get processed, they get stamped, and then they, once there's a stamp on them, then they go into more legal status. So I've mentioned the anti-corruption drives, but very, very quickly, there's so many barriers to small and medium enterprises developing because of this informality, because of the state capture and the seeking of rent. So we talk about in the book a great deal about this, about small enterprises keeping small so they remain hidden. They only have to pay bribes or make informal payments to certain people. It's very difficult to hire labour. So it's just, let's just keep it informal. But that means you can't get bank credit, you can't expand, you can't become, you can't move outside of the region. And I would argue that Russia's complete failure to diversify is down to this. And it's stuck in the petrogas trap. And just as a pessimistic conclusion is, there's a big economic crisis coming in Russia. And that was before the Ukrainian situation started. I mean, the currency is about 25% weaker than it was this time last year. Big state enterprises are laying off a lot of workers. And obviously because of the central control, is there must be very serious problems if big banks, for example, state-owned banks, are being allowed to lose labour. And I would argue that when the crash comes, informal payments will reduce dramatically, and you've got no recourse to that because, by definition, there's no paperwork. So, people's salaries would decline dramatically. And the big problem for Russia, and like in previous crises, is there's a vast amount of credit now, whether it's mortgage, for cars, for consumer goods. So I think the coming crisis is going to be much, much harder. And if Russia is, as it looks increasingly likely, isolated from Europe and from America, is going to have a dramatic effect. So I think we will see another reworking of the everyday and another role of the informal within that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. All right, Nicolette.
Okay. I'm going to be speaking about a volume which I'm editing with my colleague David Hennig. I actually have a PowerPoint. We can swap places. Yeah. That might be the easiest. See if I can locate. With the name Economies of Favour After Socialism, I'm sure that you all recognise where we've pilfered at least the phrase from. And really, it sort of started as a project in 2011. I met David at the time, Durham, at a seminar, and we went out to the pub, as one does afterwards, and we started talking about why there seemed to be a lack of impetus amongst scholars to really think about informal economies outside of what we thought of as the kind of the Blatt regime, so the kind of standard model. And what we did was we arranged a kind of two-day conference called Economies of Favour After Socialism, a comparative perspective, which was held in this room in 2012. And this is the book that is coming out of the conference. As I say, it's an edited volume, so it's a slightly different presentation from what you've been giving, John, because I'm not sort of going into a single research project. But what it is there's a first section of three positional papers, which were given by Chris Hahn, Alyona Ledeneva, and Caroline Humphrey, which I'll be sort of introducing later, and then six slightly shorter ethnographic chapters by young scholars, which are kind of written in dialogue with this first section. And in preparation for this session, Agnieszka asked me to kind of think about a kind of question, which was, can the formal ever exist without the informal? And I think you also answered that. And as a kind of typically anthropological approach, or David and I kind of thought about this question, and we thought about how it might be a good way of turning the ethnographic lens on ourselves as anthropologists and kind of treating our own conceptual baggage in a way that we might treat sort of the concepts of our informants. So really looking at the contents and limits of concepts such as informality or favors or the economy and relationships, its relationship to other concepts like exchange, distribution, gift, obligation, even things like friendship and kinship. So in this kind of presentation, I'm thinking about formal and informal more in terms of this kind of conceptual realm rather than speaking about sort of two modes of economic labor or boundary making between legal and bureaucratic spheres and what lies outside of them. And so apart from giving a sense of what the kind of volume will actually have as content, the presentation today was kind of written with that in mind. Now, because I have a limited amount of time, this is the negotiation that was going on, I'll skip a little bit. In the beginning, I was sort of had a little bit about the history of economies of favor and where the idea came from. But I think, as John has shown really well, you know, all of these informal economic practices that we associate with the socialist era have continued in some shape or form unabated, and perhaps even have even proliferated after 1989. And this is sort of the starting point for us, where we were thinking, okay, how can we sort of reconceive or re-understand these practices within a new kind of market capitalist present? One thing is a question of kind of challenging a kind of normative conceptual structure of what one might call transitology, and I think John is also arguing very much against this in his book. But also we felt that a lot of scholars have been quite reluctant to detach themselves from the kind of canon of political economic approaches, which kind of tend to concretize informal practices within the market or within the state bureaucracy. And we thought about, you know, what ways we might actually get out of this model and think about informality in different ways. And one of the problems, I think, with this kind of dual economy model is really that people tend to simplify, we think, the ethnographic serendipity of contemporary economic favors and try to put them in kind of categories of formal and informal and these compartments. This question of informal economy and the degree of how much it actually exists out there and how much it's actually our own conceptual toolbox and how we're actually looking at the material sort of popped up. Also, we had a problem with the tendency to conceptualize economic practices along a sort of continuum. So there's a normative judgment on one end and a sort of cultural relativist approach on the other end. And the former, that is the normative approach, tends to look at these practices as bribery or corruption. And the cultural relativist approach, you know, tends to look at how these practices are culturally embedded, but perhaps avoid sort of questions of normativity. And both tend to kind of conflate economies of favor with shadow or gray economies. And looking at sort of what we thought of as ubiquitous practices of getting by and you know, networking and knowing people and as a type of sociality, more as a type of economic practice. And I think, you know, us and several other voices within anthropology are now talking about whether this kind of transactionalist approach is really the best approach to understanding these practices. And I think it also very much leads us away from one of the kind of main observations that Aliona actually made about sort of socialist era economies of favors, that they were actually mediated through a rhetoric of friendship and mutuality, making them sort of less an economy and more a kind of system of sociality. And that's kind of where we wanted to start the debate on this question of sociality. So you could say that our volume is a particularly anthropological intervention in contemporary debates, very much looking at what one might see as the cultural side of these questions. and sort of trying to break this assumption that informality is solely a matter of political economy, but that it might be also thought of as a kind of specific form of agency or a specific form of action, and that economies of favor are precisely systems of sociality in which this agency operates. And so we're suggesting that one might be able to look at informality not just as kind of a division of economic labor, but also as a key to understanding how the economy itself is imagined and expressed in practice and cosmologically grounded for these populations in the region. So we're thinking about the ways that, you know, you can look at practices conventionally understood as part of the informal economy as embedded in other dimensions of everyday life. So religious and spiritual life, creative and imaginative practices, moral economies, notions of self-worth, and so on. And we're hoping that, you know, this offers an ethnographic critique of kind of the normative one-model-fits-all approach to the subject, but also looking at ways to reimagine the study of practices outside of the confines of this political economy of the region itself. So really, we're kind of drawing on wider anthropological debates here on the dynamics of exchange, of reciprocity, sociality, looking at the social efficacy of humor, of affect, of mutuality, generosity, but also conflict and competition, to kind of move beyond perhaps themes of corruption and scarcity that have kind of dominated the literature. And I think, you know, in considering informal practices and favors as productive of sociality as well as material value, it kind of provides an insight into the way that social and cultural imagination itself is put into work in everyday life. So I just want to start with a quote. In looking at a sort of a general approach to the questions of post-socialist economies of favor, David and I were really inspired by Keith Hart's recent observation that the informal economy does not exist in any empirical sense, but rather constitutes a kind of heuristic tool for contrasting some phenomena with what we might imagine constitutes orthodox, the orthodox of our economy. And he really sees informal economic activities as characterized neither by their irregularity or their legal status, but the fact that they fail to conform to some kind of abstract of dominant economic legal categories. So they're invisible to the bureaucratic eye, but often interdependent with formal structures and somehow built into bureaucratic kind of forms as kind of unspecified content. But he really rejects this notion that the informal economy constitutes a kind of quantifiable socioeconomic sector or reality, and sees that as a kind of an outcome of what he calls the Cold War ideology of the opposition between the state and the market and the post-war and post-colonial political projects of development. And I think he makes two really important points here. One is that he argues that these terms don't really explain what people are doing. They explain what they're not doing, but they don't actually explain what people are doing on a daily basis. And they don't really point to any active principles of why people do it. And I think he suggests really that the concept of informality tells us more about the imagined orthodoxies of academics and policymakers than about the actual nature of informal practices themselves. And he also draws the attention to the fact that a lot of these normative concepts of informality that are shared by development agencies or global financial institutions are really produced through the construction and representation of the economic sphere itself. And he really echoes a scholar called Timothy Mitchell, who observes or has observed the way that the fields of economics really create the market as an object of power and knowledge. So taking a historical view, Mitchell convincingly argues that our contemporary concept of the economy as a kind of totality of relations of production and distribution and consumption of goods and services is a discursive construction of the mid-20th century Keynesian macroeconomics. So this representation of the economy as a dynamic market relies on a kind of exclusion of the state and also the household from its remit, where the latter is kind of construed as non-economic and the former is being understood as the mechanism which actually regulates the market but is not within the economic sphere itself. And I think this kind of representation of the economy is sharing the boundaries of the regulated market is quite recognizable in kind of classic dual economy models of informal economy, as well as more recent theorizations by, for example, Castells and Portas, which see the informal economy as kind of structurally tied to formal modes of production. So reading established approaches through reading established approaches to informal economic practices through Mitchell, I think, exposes the degree to which conceptual parameters of theoretical models reflect the orthodoxies of Western neoclassical economic theory. And this is really one of the points of Chris Hahn's opening chapter in the volume, and he takes up this point in relation to socialist and post-socialist economies of favors. And he really argues that the tendency of scholars to treat economies of favor as a kind of structural outcome of the political economy of socialism is a result of the kind of constructed opposition between the redistributive command economy of the state socialism and the market economy of mainstream capitalist societies. And he targets the kind of shortage paradigm of Janusz Korczak, and shows how the representation of the socialist economy as inflexible and overly centralized is really based on the premise of Western economic liberalism. So by classifying what one could think of as the realities of socialism according to the ideals of Western political economy, economy of favors were made explicable as a kind of essential means to gain access to scarce goods in the absence of markets and transparent rules in all domains of economy. And what he's doing is trying to move beyond the kind of what he sees as the kind of biases of this liberal paradigm, and he encourages a holistic perspective on economic organization under the rubric of what he calls the human economy approach. And this is very much following the Polanyi model, where he characterizes market exchange and state-based redistribution not as kind of mutually opposing economic principles, but rather as complementary forms of integration. And Hahn also adds reciprocity. One could think of this easily as gift exchange and householding, that is subsistence production, and notes that both of these change more slowly than that of the market and the state, which are more readily the target of political and economic interventions. And I think what his contribution highlights is the fact that socialist-era conceptualizations of informality really carry a distinct set of normative parameters for political and economic action, which is very much linked to the kind of imagined geopolitical space of the Cold War international order. And I think it's important to note that Cold War observers viewed the socialist-era economies of favor not just as a type of economic practice, but also as a type of civic action. So they assumed that socialist society suffered from a social vacuum created by the lack of civil society and saw economies of favor as a kind of an alternative political arena, enabling general populations to compete for resources. And of course, after 1989, the same kind of practices which were so celebrated were beginning to be seen as kind of negative social capital, as precisely preventing the establishment of adequate connections between formal institutions of governance and population. And in her chapter, the next chapter, Alyona tells us really that Soviet-era economies of favors reduced the privilege gap between insiders and outside of centralized distribution systems, but the network based of informal governance of today's Russia, which John already mentioned, the Sistema, is more accurately described as a kind of economy of kickbacks, which excludes outsiders and rewards insiders. And despite describing post-Soviet corruption and clientelism as kind of undermining competition and weakening the rule of law, she kind of doesn't go into a very highly normative language of audit, which is kind of quite prevalent in anti-corruption discourse, and argues you know, that we shouldn't really stigmatize practices which replaced Soviet blat, and kind of look at informality as automatically equated with corruption. But rather what she does is unpack the notion of the favor and the notion of economies of favor, and really highlights what she calls a substantive, functional, and moral ambivalence. And the ambivalence of the favor, she says, stems from the fact that it arises from doing something which deviates from normal rules of obligation and reciprocity while also sustaining the norms, so making an exception that actually proves the rule. And as such, the meaning and value and effect of action remains open to interpretation to both the giver and the receiver. And at the same time, the favor eludes kind of easy theoretical categorization because it shares features of the gift, of gratuity, of obligation, but also of self-serving exchange, of calculative transactions, and of investment. And this kind of leads to normative ambivalence, where practices of favoritism and exchanges of favor are criticized by citizens, but then also tolerated where they're convenient. And I think on the last point, she finds quite a lot of good company among anthropologists in the region who've really seized on morality as kind of a device for problematizing normative discourses on informality, and are quite, happily talk about, looking at alternative moral orders, or perhaps talking about how people have a contextual sense of morality, so looking at sort of actions within given situations. But I think she goes a little bit further in that she doesn't, just relativize actions within their context, but really points out how the very acting, the act of giving and favors are tied to the kind of moral and emotional as well as material gains and losses of individuals. And this is taken up by Caroline Humphrey in the final chapter of this opening section, where she sort of goes, to the opposite side and really questions the very assumption that socialist and post-socialist era economies of favors are actually primarily driven by structural constraints of socioeconomic inequality. So while Chris Hahn sort of opens up by critiquing an economic bias or market economic bias, Humphrey queries the degree to which any of these practices should actually be understood in transactional terms at all. And she notes that favors are carried out in economies that are mainly conducted in other ways, and argues that they're actually different from transactional exchanges in that they form a distinct moral aesthetic of action, which endows actors with standing and senses of self-worth. So favors, according to Humphrey, aren't simply they don't simply challenge common sense boundaries between instrumentality and sociability, but they're actually a particular type of action that has moral value by virtue of not being understood as an exchange. And she really, what she proposes is that favor is kind of different from other modes of acting by its ethics rather than by its morphology. So she's warning us not to fall into a kind of functionalist trap of making inferences about the causes and intentions of actions based purely on their outcomes. And I think also what's interesting about her chapter is how she illustrates that the act of giving and receiving of favors activates not just the moral imagination and ethical conduct, but is involved in the production of social esteem as well as social relations. So doing things in the official, above-board way may be perfectly feasible, but actually individuals often choose to do things in a roundabout way because it does offer the opportunity for influencing the situation, or it shows intelligence and cunning, or it enhances their standing in a network of relations that matter to them. And her point is that doing and receiving favors is above all a kind of matter of personal dignity and personal reputation. And I think what's particularly interesting also in her chapter is that she's precisely writing about corruption in the school system. And, it's a very interesting way of getting to the subject. So all these chapters really bring a kind of novel conceptualization of the favor to classic concepts of economic anthropology, which are already well used in the study of economies of favor, so things like redistribution or reciprocity or gift exchange. And they suggest ways that we can reimagine informality as more than a kind of non-formalized practice of exchange. All of them also stress the kind of value of the ethnographic method for generating context-driven interpretations of the role of post-socialist economies of favors. And I think they're also looking for a kind of wider recognition of activities which fall under the rubric of economies of favors, so that they don't sort of just look at small-scale enterprise or paid work, but also looking at various practices of self-provisioning, unpaid work, exchange undertaken under kinship or social obligations, community projects, and a kind of the phenomena of paid favors between kin and acquaintances. So I think in some ways they're replicating the iceberg that you were showing. Rather than looking at sort of to build a typology, I think there's more an interest in kind of finding out how these things are existential and constitutive of persons and relations, rather than sort of just looking at it as calculative or instrumental or gratuitous, but actually looking at how these relationships and these exchanges actually constitute social life, sociality, and personhood. And all of these points are reflected in various different ways in the second section, which consists of six short ethnographic chapters. I'm not going to speak about all of them. We chose four for today because I don't have the time to go through each chapter.
You've got 5 minutes.
I've got 5 minutes. Okay, I'll try and hurry up. So the chapters can be sort of loosely grouped around three major themes or observations. One of them is looking at how post-socialist economies of favors are involved in the creation of kind of imagined social consensus in times of hardship or in times of conflict. And one of these is Tomasz Rakowski's chapter, another is Katie Swancutz, who I'm not going to talk about today, but both of them explore how ethics and aesthetics intersect in the performance of unregulated labor and exchange and the fulfillment of kinship obligations, and how these are actually reflected in the kind of bodily experience and bodily practice of everyday life. And Akovsky describes bootleg mining and scavenging for scrap metal undertaken by unemployed miners in the Polish district of Wałbrzych. And he illustrates how these practices of hunting and gathering, as he calls it, not only requires ex-miners to employ their professional skills to kind of strip and recycle and sell the environment around them, but also depends largely on the willingness for the local authorities to turn a blind eye and to kind of pretend to not see what's happening. And I think the interesting thing is he focuses really on how these miners explain their practice to themselves. So previously they are sort of celebrated as kind of the vanguards of the socialist working class. And now they have to reconcile, you know, themselves with the fact that their present practice, which they understand as honest labor, is illegal, and they've also suffered this loss of social status. And he talks about how they comment upon and justify their kind of their practice, balancing between ideas of law and lawlessness through lots of narratives and joking. And usually these narratives talk about exceptional luck or cunning, or they mock legal and religious authorities. And this is very carnivalesque and playful. He calls these the interior spectacles. This is really a way for them to kind of grasp and come to terms with their own situation. And these interior spectacles reconfigure the kind of very precarious nature of their livelihoods into stories about the easy life, about how easy it is to scavenge off the leftovers of the socialist past. And I think what's very nice about his ethnography is that it illustrates how informal economic activities, like petty bribery or establishing the connections with persons of authority, constitutes more than a kind of survival strategy, but is actually reflected upon by the protagonists themselves with a lot of humor and with a lot of narrative. It becomes part of these men's identities. It kind of allows them to redefine themselves in a kind of imagined social structure. And these two contributions kind of recognize the importance of economies of favor for the creation of the social imaginary. Two other contributions highlight the way that economies of favor are embedded in historical and religious imaginaries, or to use the anthropological jargon, the cosmo-economical entanglements of these practices. And I think I'll skip one. I'll just talk about David Hennig's chapter, which explores the way that pilfering and petty corruption and the use of connections becomes entangled with Muslim moral cosmologies in Bosnia. And he documents how villagers struggle to balance being a good Muslim with simply getting by in a society which they see as very morally corrupt and economically insecure. And he shows how economies of favors can't easily be categorized as haram, that is immoral or forbidden, or as halal, moral or virtuous. And while the local religious establishment kind of follows the rhetoric of international NGOs and financial organizations and collapses petty bribery and large-scale corruption into one category, villagers often don't see the use of connections as somehow morally dubious, even though they know they're legally questionable. Rather, favors, including getting someone a job, allowing access to public services, turning a blind eye to petty theft of public property, is often interpreted as a kind of part of a vital exchange of good deeds between the living, the dead, and the Almighty. So construed as helping out religious constituents and kin and fellow villagers, these sorts of gestures are not just part of an economy of favors, but become part of a religious economy of good deeds. And finally, the last two chapters, one by myself and the other by Madeline Reeves, probe the ways that local concept of gratuitous action become articulated with different formal and ethical parameters of kinship obligations, commercial exchange, and practices of gifting. And each in our own way, our chapters really focus on the tension between kinship obligation and commercial competition and throw light on how distinctions between gift-giving and social obligation and corruption influence the way transfers of materials and money are understood and enacted. Quite aptly, Madeline writes about the temporary housing market for Kyrgyz migrants in Moscow, so your illustrations are quite fitting here. And she explores how economies of favors, the kind of economies of favors that emerge as migrants search for temporary cheap accommodation in the face of discrimination and harassment from immigration authorities. So migrant workers depend on a range of brokers to provide living space, and typically what happens is a well-established migrant who commands a sufficiently large network will rent out an apartment and then sublet, quite literally, mattress space to up to other 20 other fellow Kyrgyz, and this could be kin, acquaintances, and complete strangers. And she paints a really vivid and remarkable picture of the social life of the inhabitants of these communal apartments and uses the ethnography to test the notion of favors and their limits in the context of the market and shows how different rationalities of exchange hold in different places, not just between different categories of persons, so between kin and acquaintance or between countrymen, but also how they're shaped by different social and geographical spaces. So a gesture taken as a favor in Kyrgyzstan may require a market transaction in Moscow. You know, typically, mutual help will become somehow commercialized. But you also have situations where new obligations are put on migrants by their expectant kin who are waiting at home for remittances. And I think, you know, she very well recalls Yadinova's point that about the ambiguities of favors and notes that while favors, you know, analytically might be rendered distinct and separated out from instrumental or calculative exchange, ethnographically, this distinction is far less clear. I think I'll stop.
Thank you very much.
I've run out of time.
Great. Well, thank you to both.